The short story, stripping. They must really fry your brains at that job. It was Larry Murphy, and his comment shook me out of my stripper-induced trance. Stripping old furniture, that is, I had rescued from countless estate sales and alleys of Detroit. The smell of varnish and paint remover had replaced Polo as the scent that followed me everywhere these days. For you to do that crap for fun absolutely blows my mind, Murphy continued as he walked across our backyard. It's a catharsis, Larry, I responded. Yeah, and you know what you get from cathartics, he shot back. Shit, I answered obediently. Absolutely, he said with a smile. I was a little disappointed. If anyone could understand my latest passion, I thought it would be Larry. This was the man educated by the Jesuits with a couple of PhDs who turned his back on everything conventional to be a Buddhist and an engineer on the railroad. You don't understand. I'm stripping away years of obscurity. I'm rescuing this old cupboard from an inevitable death. I'm giving it new life, and that makes me feel good. When I was through with my defense, he just smiled, shook his head, and walked to his back porch. When he got to the top step, he turned and proclaimed, "If it feels good, do it. But you gotta promise to come out with me sometime, and I'll show you some real fun. Okay?" "You've got it," I responded. Right now, however, this cupboard was starting to look awfully good, but Larry didn't want to hear that. I rubbed my hands over the wood grain I had just uncovered as Larry disappeared from view. I liked working with my hands, even though I was never one of those guys who was particularly talented when it came to building things. Maybe this was my niche, stripping and refinishing old furniture. Get a truck and a warehouse and, who knows, maybe even happiness, the kind of happiness everyone longs for. The uncomplicated life that so many have sought by dropping out of the mainstream to pursue. I was starting to understand why old men often retire to their basement or garage workshops. My first wife's grandfather, with his pipe stem clenched firmly in his mouth, used to work for hours on projects he never seemed to finish. Oftentimes, he'd organize, reorganize his tools, nails, and screws that he safely stored in old peanut butter jars. There was a sense of order and security there that I now understand. It was his space, safe from the outside world, and that included his wife. These places also have their very own aroma, a perfect mixture of turpentine, varnish, and freshly cut wood. "What are you doing?" It was Dr. Dick Ludwig, my psychologist neighbor, returning home from a rough day of dealing with those advantaged enough to afford their illness and his fees. "Oh, I'm just refinishing this old cupboard," I responded. "And it's looking good, too, guy," he shot back, almost too quickly. I always had the feeling that Dr. Dick said whatever he thought I wanted to hear. Maybe it was an occupational hazard, but this time, he was right. It was starting to look good, and after Larry's comments, I welcomed his approval. "Hey, how about going to the Bronx for a beer? Does that sound like a good idea?" he asked. "Sounds like a great idea, Doc. Just give me a few minutes to wash up," I answered. "You got it, big guy." The Bronx was a neighborhood watering hole that had been around since the Purple Gang days, and the nude painting of Jean Harlow behind the bar added to its mystique. The Bronx was just a few blocks away, but any distance in the corridor at night was a bit too far. "Don't worry," Dr. Dick said, as if he were reading my thoughts. "I'm packing some heat," he announced proudly. "You carrying a gun, Doc?" "Mace," he responded. "I don't go anywhere in this neighborhood without it." "Not to worry, Douglas. Dr. Dick is here." Harassment or not, just then I decided it might be a good idea to invite Larry Murphy to come along. However, by the time I washed up, Larry was nowhere to be found, so it was just me, Dr. Dick, and his mace. By the time we reached the Bronx, it was full of locals. Around since the early 20s, The Bronx was a real neighborhood bar, and it smelled like it, with floors saturated with decades of spilled beer and whiskey and who knows what else. "Hey, stripper!" someone shouted from across the smoke-filled room. I looked around and spotted Larry Murphy at the pool table. I left Dr. Dick at the bar and moved over to where Larry was standing. He was dressed in nothing but his blue Oshkosh bib overalls and work shoes. His now-famous Popeye-sized arms made the pool cue he was holding look small. "You gonna go with me for that good time I promised you? What's the occasion?" "Don't need any special occasion to have a good time. Just the desire," he said, smiling. "I got the desire," I answered, "but it will have to wait for another time." "Halloween?" he shot back. "Halloween?" I asked. "Sure, there's always a good time in the corridor on Halloween." "Then Halloween it is," I answered, as I walked back to the bar where Dr. Dick had a cold Stroh's and a shot of Dewar's waiting for me. "Looks like we're celebrating something, huh, Doc?" He just raised the shot glass to his lips, tipped it up, savoring every drop as the glass emptied. I followed suit and chased it with a gulp of Stroh's. "How about another?" Dick said, still smiling as if he either knew something I didn't know or he was just starting to feel the buzz. "You're not a short ball hitter, are you?" "Could be, but only time will tell." Dr. Dick turned to Malvin, the proud owner of the Bronx, and said, "Give my friend here another shot because we're about to step up to the plate." The last thing I clearly remember was Hank Williams Jr. singing his family tradition as it blared out of the Bronx's dated jukebox. Several Stroh's and Dewar's later, we made our way back to our Second Avenue fortress. As we left the Bronx, Dr. Dick announced to me again not to worry because he was armed with his trusty mace. When we reached the terraces, he insisted on stopping by his place and sharing some Polish kielbasa before we called it a night. "Is this some sort of tradition, Doc?" He looked astonished as he fished his delicacy out of a giant jar. "Absolutely. I think I'll pass this time, Doc." He smiled and then announced, "You are a short ball hitter after all." My response was interrupted by a heavy pounding on the back door. It was Morris Crispin's. He was frantic and cried out, "I think something terrible has happened to Kevin." Kevin was Kevin Hardy, a single school teacher and swimming coach who lived in the end row house on the alley. "There's blood everywhere, and there's no trace of Kevin anywhere," he continued. "Morris, wait till I run next door and get my gun." I ran past Morris as Dr. Dick shouted, "I'll bring my mace." That was reassuring. By the time I got to Kevin's, Doc and Morris were already standing on the back steps. "Why don't you go first?" Dr. Dick gestured to me as he pulled out his can of mace. The back door led directly to the kitchen, where the wall was splattered with bloodstains. "Oh, my God," Dr. Dick gasped. "Doesn't look good," Morris added. "Look, the window shattered," Doc interrupted. I walked over to the sink beneath the window. Sure enough, the window had been broken, and there were numerous bloodstains on the windowsill as well as the sink. The strange thing about blood is that you know it's blood as soon as you see it. Ketchup may work in movies, but in real life, blood is blood, and its color, especially on a white sink, is unmistakable. As I looked out the window to the alley below, I was surprised to see a pile of clothes. They too were smeared with blood. We walked throughout the first floor silently in single file. We all feared what we would find. And when we found nothing, I gestured to the others with my Colt in the direction of the second floor. As we walked up the servants' back stairway, we discovered more bloodstains on the wall. The second floor also yielded nothing. There was only one more floor to go, and that is where Kevin's bedroom was located. It's strange how your mind works. I kept getting flashback images of a party I had attended here at Kevin's just a few weeks before. It sent my emotions on a roller coaster ride. We all looked at each other, knowing we eventually had to climb the staircase to that third floor. It was obvious by the look in my friend's eyes that we were all afraid of what we might find. I can tell you that this is a fear that seems greater and even more paralyzing than if it were you, yourself, that was facing the threat of violence. We climbed these final steps as quietly as we could. When we reached the hallway, we could see that Kevin's bedroom door was ajar. We could see the mattress had been overturned, and several blood-stained handprints were on the wall next to the bed. Terror raced through me as I became convinced that we were about to find Kevin under that blood-stained mattress. And if we did, I feared the worst. I've seen someone dead before, so it wasn't the fear of seeing a dead body. But this was a friend, a person I had shared life with on many occasions. We walked slowly over to the overturned mattress. We were all about to get ill just from the anticipation. It now seemed obvious, almost predictable. Morris reached down, picked up the edge of the mattress. "Is this place a mess or what?" It was Kevin, not under the mattress, but standing in the doorway. "Jesus Christ, Kevin, you asshole! What are you doing there?" Both Dr. Dick and Morris rushed over to him. "Would you rather I was under the mattress?" "No, but son of a bitch, you scared the shit out of us. Where in the hell were you?" "Actually, I went over to the Tomboy Market to use the payphone to call the cops. I was afraid to use my phone for fear of screwing up some fingerprints." "You mean blood prints?" "Yeah, whoever did this cut the shit out of themselves," Morris declared. "We could probably track him just by following the bloodstains," Dr. Dick added. "Be sure to take your mace," Kevin advised. "Kevin, were you here when he broke in?" "No, he came through the kitchen window on the alley and must have cut himself when he broke the window," Kevin answered. "He lost a lot of blood. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he cut an artery," announced Dr. Dick. "I hope the son of a bitch dies," Morris said, releasing years of corridor frustration. "Well, I know one thing. I'm not staying here tonight." "Good idea, Kevin," Morris continued. "They often come back to the scene of the crime." "That's a pleasant thought. Thanks, Morris." "He's right, Kevin. Once they find a weak link, they attack it again and again," echoed Dr. Dick.
Morris knew what he was talking about after living in the corridor for more than 20 years. As newcomers, this was our first experience. We all knew it could happen, and now it had. But we also knew it could have been much worse.